Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have back with me today the one and only Dr. Tim Kaistura for another ACRAC keyword episode. We're going to talk about respiratory physiology today, which is a highly tested topic, and I am excited to review it. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, as always. And first things first, it's going to be a little bit of review time.
Fabulous.
Question one. Which of the following is the most common peripheral nerve injury associated with general anesthesia? A, ulnar nerve, B, median nerve, or C, common peroneal nerve?
All right. Well, we did talk about this in a prior episode, hence the review. And I think that the common mistake here is to say common peroneal or peroneal nerve because it can be injured, as we talked about, in stirrups. But the most common peripheral nerve injury is the ulnar nerve, as it is unprotected in the ulnar groove there in the arm. And so that's going to be your answer here.
That's correct. And yep, it's. I thought it was a good one to review because it's one of those things you just have to know. No real way to reason your way into that answer. Question two, a patient in a post-anesthesia care unit with a normal VD-VT ratio of 30% suffers from a pulmonary embolism with an increase of their VD-VT ratio to 60%. To maintain constant alveolar ventilation, the patient will compensate by doing which of the following? A, decrease their tidal volumes, B, increase their respiratory rate, or C, maintain their current tidal volume.
Right. So this is going back to our episode that included pulmonary embolus, and you now have more dead space because of the pulmonary embolus. And so if you have more dead space, but you still want to exchange the same amount of gas, you have to increase your minute ventilation. And so the answer that does that here is increase your respiratory rate. So that's what you're going to do.
That is perfect. And that's a great explanation of a little bit of what we'll see when we talk about dead space later, since we are in the respiratory physiology section of the keywords today.
Nice segue. I like it.
Question three, which of the following is least likely to be a good candidate for surgery at an ambulatory center? A, an 86-year-old male with high blood pressure undergoing a cystoscopy. B, a 55-year-old female status post liver transplant 1 year ago undergoing cataract surgery. Or C, a 47-year-old female with CAD status post drug-eluting stent placement 2 months ago undergoing a ventral hernia repair.
All right. So they're trying to get you here with the 86-year-old, making you think, uh-oh, old person, high blood pressure. That's scary. But a cystoscopy is a very low intensity surgery, and there's not a lot going on there with just some high blood pressure. But that 47-year-old, though young, had a drug-eluting stent just 2 months ago, and that is going to, for sure, mean she's not a good candidate for an ambulatory center.
Yep. And as a reminder there, and often another tested thing is just sort of how long do you wait after stent placement? And for a drug-eluting stent, that would be 6 months before you would consider surgery, even if it is minor like that.
Absolutely.
Especially if it's elective. Four, a middle-aged male returns for the next session of ongoing outpatient electroconvulsive therapy. His home medications include metoprolol, lorazepam, and occasional acetaminophen, which he took this morning. Which medication should be administered before inducing a seizure? A, N-acetylcysteine, B, glucagon, or C, flumazenil?
All right. So hopefully it's pretty clear that lorazepam is an benzodiazepine that is an anti-epileptic. And so if you've got that on board, it's going to make it hard to induce a seizure. So reversing that is going to make it more likely, and that's what you want for ECT. So flumazenil is the reversal for lorazepam, and that should be the answer.
Perfect. And now we'll hop into today's topic, which is respiratory physiology. This appears in both the basic and advanced outlines, though the coverage is much more broad in the basic outline, with just a little bit in advance. These sections spell out a lot of detailed subtopics you need to know, and though I usually read the outline in full, I'll refrain from reading it verbatim today. In some granularity, this is section one, basic outline, C, organ-based advanced clinical, two, respiratory system. We have A, physiology, lung functions and cellular processes, and this is where everything fits. One is lung volume, such as static and dynamic volumes and dead space. Two is lung mechanics, such as static and dynamic compliance and surfactant and Laplace law. Ventilation perfusion, that's where distribution of ventilation and the west zones sit. 4 is diffusion with apneic oxygenation and diffusion hypoxia. 5 is blood gas with O2 transport, CO2 transport, the Bohr effect, Haldane effect, systemic effects of hypercarbia, hypocarbia, hyperoxia, and hypoxemia. 6 is control of ventilation. 7 is non-respiratory functions of the lungs, including metabolic and immune functions. And then 8 is perioperative smoking. And like I said, this basic section is really long. The advanced section is much shorter. It sits in a very similar area, but the only thing they define within physiology is ventilation and perfusion, and they have some advanced topics within that. So we're going to hit on the highly tested aspects of most of that today. It's one of those places in the outline where there's a ton of content, but relatively fewer things that get tested. The things that get tested often, but they don't test all of these things. And there's some overlap with other portions of the outline. For instance, we'll skip basic interpretation of arterial blood gas today, since that's better covered in biochemistry. In control of ventilation, I feel like we covered well enough when we talked about central nervous and peripheral nervous system anatomy, so we'll skip that. And I've grouped the rest into sections with similar themes. I mean, to get started.
Ready. Let's do it.
Right. Section 1 is going to be lung volumes, capacities, and dead space. The 4 lung volumes are tidal, inspiratory reserve, expiratory reserve, and residual, and they don't overlap. And a capacity is just 2 or more of those added together. Vital capacity is everything you can move from a maximal inspiration to maximal expiration. Functional residual capacity, which is your expiratory reserve volume and residual volume, is the gas left after a normal passive exhale and serves as the oxygen reservoir during apnea. Residual volume and your FRC can't be measured by spirometry. They need body plethysmography or gas dilution. In dead space is ventilation that doesn't exchange gas. It comes in 3 flavors: anatomic, the conducting airways; alveolar, the alveoli that are ventilated but not perfused; and physiologic, which is the 2 of them combined. So that's sort of your basic foundational knowledge that you need for those topics. And a couple of key concepts. The first one about FRC and closing capacity. Vital capacity is roughly 60 to 70 mLs per kilogram, or around 5 liters for a normal-sized human adult. FRC falls with induction, with supine positioning, with obesity, and with pregnancy. And when it drops below closing capacity, small airways start to close during tidal breathing, and you get shunt and hypoxia as a result of that. Aging raises the closing capacity, and pregnancy lowers FRC, while closing capacity stays put during pregnancy.
And I'll just add that that vital capacity number, 60 to 70 mLs per kilo, is not total body weight, because you can imagine, if you've ever seen a CT scan of a patient with a BMI, let's say, of 70, there's normal-looking lungs, the same size as a patient with a BMI of 25, and then all this soft tissue around it. So the lungs don't grow when you become obese. So the lungs are the same, and those vital capacity is ideal body weight, not total body weight.
A really good clarification. Thank you. And key concept 2 about dead space and dead space fraction, which we saw a little bit of in the review questions. Anatomic dead space is about 2 mLs per kilogram, or about 150 mLs in a 70-kilogram adult. And the dead space fraction, VD, VT, comes from the Bohr equation, which is your PaCO2 minus your expired CO2 divided by that product, or that difference divided by the PaCO2. So it's PaCO2 minus PeCO2 divided by PaCO2. And the wider the gap between arterial and mixed expired CO2, the larger the dead space.
And I'll just point out too, that PeCO2 is not something actually we're used to looking at, because it is not PETCO2. It's not end-tidal CO2. It is the average exhaled CO2 over the entire exhalation, which is different than end-tidal CO2. So keep that in mind.
Perfect. That's exactly what I wanted to clarify too. All right. That means you are ready for some questions.
Let's do it.
Question 1. A frail 42-kilogram, 170-centimeter male with a measured vital capacity of 4 liters lies down on an operating room bed prior to induction of anesthesia. Compared to his measured baseline, his vital capacity is now most likely A, more than 4 liters, B, about 4 liters, or C, less than 4 liters.
Yeah, and so when you lay down, you start to have some lung collapse. So you're going to have less vital capacity than you did when you were supine. When you were standing up. So laying down is going to lower your vital capacity. It's going to be less than 4 liters.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, you often see this tested in terms of FRC as well. It's the same thing with FRC. We talked about those changes of FRC. You'll see that lower as well. Question two, which of the following is most likely to remain unchanged in a pregnant patient by the end of the third trimester? A, closing capacity, B, functional residual capacity, or C, minimum alveolar concentration of inhalational agents?
And as you mentioned, that in pregnancy, you do get a decrease in FRC, but closing capacity stays the same. And then also we know that MAC is decreased in pregnant patients. So we know that B and C go down, but closing capacity stays the same. And kind of that's what happens is that when your FRC decreases and your closing capacity stays the same, you get more collapse. So that's same with patients who are very obese. You start to get a lower FRC and more collapse at baseline.
Perfect. And that explains the decreased apnea time in all of those patients. Question three, the anatomic dead space in a 70-kilogram male is A, 50 milliliters, B, 150 milliliters, or C, 250 milliliters.
And as you said before, the amount is about 2 mLs per kilo, so about 150 is going to be the answer here. It's closest to 140, so 150 is the answer.
Perfect. And as much as I hate making us do math on the air, unfortunately, in respiratory physiology, a lot of these questions on the basic exam are asked in terms of do you know the formulas? So we'll do it again in question four. Calculate the VD-VT ratio, or the physiologic dead space ventilation, based on the following data. You have a PaCO2 of 45, a mixed expired CO2 tension of 30. Is your VD-VT ratio A, 0.1, B, 0.2, or C, 0.3?
So you got to know the equation here, we already said, which is PaCO2 minus PeCO2 divided by PaCO2. So 45 minus 30 divided by 45 is 15 divided by 45 is 0.3.
That's right. And I will just point out as sort of a test-taking skill, if you ever are calculating ratios and you've gotten yourself confused as to how to do it, you don't remember the exact ratio, if you go with big minus small divided by big, it's probably 80% of the time you're getting the ratio correct there. And that's the way it's working in this question as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, also you can look and say, well, is there even a way to get to 0.1 or 0.2, right? I mean, there may not.
Yes.
So if you just quickly look and you think, like, I can't even see, even if I don't know the equation, I can't see how these two numbers could be put together in a way that's going to get me some of these answers. You can cross out some of the answers.
Agreed. All right. Section two will be respiratory mechanics and spirometry. Compliance is the volume change for a given change in transpulmonary pressure or distensibility, and elastance is its inverse. Surfactant lowers alveolar surface tension and keeps small alveoli from emptying into large ones. And remember the law of Laplace, in which pressure needed to keep the alveoli open is related to tension, directly proportional to tension and inversely proportional to radius. So the key concepts here, key concept three, is that airway resistance depends on flow character. This is tested often. Laminar flow follows Passau's law, radius to the fourth power, and depends on viscosity, while turbulent flow depends on density. Do you have a good way to keep those straight, Jed?
No, I do not. Do you?
I do not. I have rememorized this for every single test I've taken. I think it's on my list of things to look at the night before and smash into my brain yet again. If I think of something, I'll certainly add it in the comments at some point.
Yeah.
And keep on...
No, I'm just looking and thinking, turbulent, dense, you know, is there, nothing that jumps out at me. Laminar, viscosity, no, nothing.
I've tried to make it make sense so many times. Key concept four, work of breathing is basically pressure times volume. And at rest, it consumes only 2% of the total body oxygen. anything that cuts FRC, like pneumoperitoneum during laparoscopy, lowers compliance and worsens oxygenation. Key concept 5, obstruction drops VEF1 disproportionately. So you get a low FEV1 to FVC ratio, normal to high total lung capacity, while restriction drops both FVC and FEV1 together. So you have a normal ratio, but a low total lung capacity. And FEV1 is the best marker of severity in obstructive diseases such as cystic fibrosis. Question 5. During a normal tidal volume 500 ml breath, the transpulmonary pressure increases from 0 to 5 centimeters of water. The product of transpulmonary pressure and VT is 2,500 centimeters of water ml. This expression of the pressure-volume relationship during breathing determines what parameter of respiratory mechanics.
And as you said, worker breathing is defined as pressure times volume. Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't read the answer choices. Go ahead.
No. As you point out, if you know the answer, you should just look for the answer. And you're looking for work of breathing, which is answer A. Your other options are B, lung compliance, and C, airway resistance. So I'll go ahead and put you on the spot. You knew that the product is work of breathing. So what relationship between those values would give you lung compliance and which would give you airway resistance?
Right. So lung compliance is volume over change in pressure. So I think of that as for any given change in pressure, how much is the lung going to change in volume? In other words, a very compliant lung with just a little pressure, you're going to get a big change in volume. So that's compliance. And then resistance is the inverse of that. So it's pressure divided by volume. And so the opposite, right? You can just think of it as with a change in volume, it's to have high resistance, it means a small change in volume, a large change in pressure. So it's going to take a lot of pressure to make a small volume change. Hey folks, I just want to take a second to shout out our rockstar returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME Smart Bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training and an adult cardiac anesthesiology Smart Bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex Smart Bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG. All right, and now back to our keyword episode.
Question 6. What is the most likely physiologic response to abdominal carbon dioxide insufflation during laparoscopic abdominal surgery? Is it A, decreased arterial oxygenation, B, increased lung compliance, or C, decreased intrapulmonary shunt?
So you can do a little process of elimination here. If you're distending the abdomen and you're therefore increasing the pressure around the lungs in the pleural space, you're definitely not increasing lung compliance. The lungs are going to have a harder time opening and filling with volume. So lung compliance is going to go down, so it can't be B. Decreased intrapulmonary shunt, even if you're not sure, you should think, well, it's probably not going to decrease it, right? If you think about increased pressure in the thorax, you're going to be, if it's enough pressure, you're going to actually close down some of the airways and also some of the vessels. And so that's just going to increase VQ mismatch and probably increase shunt. So you're going to definitely not decrease shunt. So you can, by process of elimination, end up at A. But also, if you think that CO2 doesn't just sit there, it gets absorbed and it gets into the circulation. And if you have more CO2, you're going to have less oxygen. So by definition, you're going to decrease arterial oxygenation.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about that aspect of the where carbon dioxide and oxygen mix and then how they affect each other, but that's totally true. This is sort of a shout back to key concept 4, right? Anything that cuts your FRC is going to lower compliance and worsen your oxygenation. But for all the reasons you stated, decreased arterial oxygenation is the best choice.
Great.
And then question 7, the last one for this section. A decrease in which component of pulmonary function testing is the best indicator of disease severity in patients with cystic fibrosis? A, residual volume. B, forced expiratory flow at 25 to 75% of lung volume. Or C, forced expiratory volume in 1 second, FEV1.
And this is a little tricky because people may know that we often talk about the FEV 25 to 75 as the least effort dependent and so maybe the best predictor because people can't – it doesn't really depend on how much effort they put into it. But as you said in your introduction, with cystic fibrosis especially, the FEV1 is thought of as the best indicator of disease severity. So the right answer here is C.
Right. And I would love to not see these two things tested against each other, but I would go with FEV1 for obstructive diseases, absolutely for cystic fibrosis, if forced to choose.
Great. Section and I think three, the reason, by the way, is that I think their assumption is that in a test situation, they're assuming that you get complete effort, right? They're not testing you on the patient who isn't, right, unless they said it. I mean, the way they would get to 25 to 75 is if they said, you know, a patient is somewhat sedated and you're not sure that they're giving full effort, which is the best test, right? But if they don't say that, I think you should assume that you have a patient who's giving a full effort.
That's a really good point. All right. Section three is going to be ventilation perfusion matching and HPV. Gravity makes both ventilation and perfusion greater at the dependent lung, but perfusion is more susceptible to this effect. And the result is a VQ ratio, ventilation to perfusion ratio, that is high at the apex and low at the base when you're sitting or standing. If you're supine or you're lateral, you have to think about what's actually dependent. And West zones formalize this. Zone one is the alveolar pressure being higher than arterial pressure, and that occurs in the apex while sitting or standing. While zone three, where the arterial is greater than the venous, greater than the alveolar, is the well-perfused base of the lung. The high VQ apical units, where you have a lot of ventilation, not a lot of flow, act a little bit like dead space. You have higher PaO2 and lower PaCO2 as a result. And the low VQ basal units act a little bit like shunt.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, ACRackers. Has your routine taken a hit these past couple of months with summer travel and all your other obligations? Well, if you're like me, you feel the need to get back to eating real food, and Factor makes that easy, even when you're on the go. Factor makes chef-crafted, dietitian-designed, ready-to-eat meals so you don't have to choose between real food and convenience. Factor meals are ready in 2 minutes and require no prep and no cleanup, so even on the days your schedule's completely out of control, eating well is still achievable. Every week you'll find over 100 nutrient-dense items to choose from and new options like salmon burgers, shredded pork, collard greens, and more, plus add-ons you'll crave like pumpkin-flavored cheesecakes and protein shakes. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Some of our favorites right now are the shredded chicken taco bowl and the buffalo ranch burger. Let's eat real. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and one free breakfast item per box for 1 year while supplies last until 10/31/26. That's code ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com. ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com. See website for more details. Hey folks, August is the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush begins, and honestly, I can't think of a better place to start than my closet. That's why I love shopping at Quince. Quince is all about fewer, better pieces. Their clothes are made with premium materials, built to last, and designed to become the ones you reach for day after day. They specialize in everyday staples that work harder, like their ultra-soft organic cotton tees and premium Mongolian cashmere sweaters. If you're still hanging on to the same worn-out basics, Quince makes it easy to upgrade. They have premium denim and tailored chinos from just $60 with the kind of high-quality fabrics you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. I absolutely love the new swim trunks I got from Quince. They have a comfortable inner liner, and they look great. Even my wife and daughters give them a thumbs up, and that is a rare thing. Upgrade your everyday. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC.
Hey, folks. I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think could truly make a difference for healthcare workers, Figs scrubs. I love my Figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves her so much that's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all Figs all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, a CRNA, or a CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple pairs of Figs is totally worth it. And now it's here, back to school season. And while that means lectures, labs, and late nights for healthcare workers in training, it also is a reminder that in medicine, education never really ends. And right now, Figs, the premium apparel brand for healthcare professionals, just dropped fresh colors and exclusive back to school styles. And the best part, everything is 20% off site wide for a limited time. From scrubs to outerwear to footwear and beyond, Figs keeps awesome humans looking sharp, performing their best, and ready to take on anything from marathon lab sessions to 12-hour shifts. So if you're in healthcare or know someone who is, don't miss out on 20% off for back to school, happening now through August 11th at wearfigs.com. That's wearfigs.com.
Hey folks, this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You've heard me talk about BetterHelp for a long time, but I don't know that we've ever actually talked about how much people love this service when they use it. You can check it out yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews to see amazing customer reviews in real time. The reviews are updated every day with hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how helpful it's been to them. Please visit betterhelp.com/reviews to see for yourself. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people who have actually used the service speaks for itself. More than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally. The consistent feedback from real users makes it easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists have at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of hands-on experience. They also hold all required education, training, and certifications across a range of mental health specialties. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. That's betterhelp.com. Visit betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com.
All right, and we're back.
Key concept six in this area, a reminder that the apex is high VQ, the base is low VQ when you're sitting or standing. And both ventilation and perfusion are greatest at the base, but perfusion more so, which is why the ratio still favors the apex. And key concept seven, alveolar hypoxia constricts the pulmonary vasculature. That's the opposite of a systemic circulation, diverting blood towards better ventilated lung. This happens to be one of the physiological reasons that one lung ventilation can be tolerated. The other is that we tend to turn patients laterally during these cases, which helps blood flow get to the dependent lung. And HPV is blunted by volatiles and vasodilators. And pulmonary vascular resistance is lowest at FRC. So the high volume when you inhale compresses alveolar vessels. And when you exhale everything, the low volume sort of kinks the extra alveolar vessels. So in both of those areas, your pulmonary, in both of those situations, the pulmonary vascular resistance is higher than right at FRC. It's a U-shaped curve. Ready for some questions?
Let's do it.
Question eight. Which of the following statements concerning the distribution of alveolar ventilation in the upright lungs is true? A, alveoli at the apex of the lungs are better ventilated than those at the base. B, alveoli at the base of the lungs are better ventilated than those at the apex. And C, the distribution of ventilation is not affected by body posture.
Yeah, and this is really key because I think this is tricky because if you think ventilation, you may think aeration, and that's not the same thing. They're talking here in terms of ventilation about the exchange of CO2 as opposed to oxygenation. So alveoli at the base of the lungs are better ventilated, by which we mean there is more CO2 delivered to the alveoli by the blood, and that is because they are better perfused. So tricky. If it said better perfused, you'd probably definitely get it. You'd say, oh, better perfused at the base. But when it says ventilated, they're talking about perfusion because they're talking about exchange of CO2. So be careful there. So the answer here is B, that there's more CO2 exchange at the base.
That's really well said. It's sort of when you think about respiration, or you're worried about, is your ventilation good enough? That's an exchange of CO2. And is your oxygenation good enough? Question nine, which of the following statements concerning the distribution of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the upright lungs is true? A, both PaO2 and PaCO2 are greater at the base than at the apex. B, PaO2 is greater at the apex than at the base. And C, PaCO2 is greater at the apex than at the base.
Right. So this is kind of the converse of what we just said. So PaO2 is greater at the apex, and that's going to be your answer here.
Right. That's a little bit of dead space. It's not well ventilated. You have more PaO2 than PCO2 at that point. Good. So a couple of questions that drive that idea home. And we'll move on to section 4. Gas exchange, the A, gradient, shunt, and diffusion are sort of the most tested things here. And the alveolar gas equation gives the PO2 you should see in the alveolus. So P big AO2, alveolar pressure, partial pressure of oxygen, is equal to your inhaled oxygen multiplied by your atmospheric pressure minus the water pressure. And you subtract from that the P little a CO2 divided by the respiratory quotient. I will refer you to any textbook to look at that equation in writing, but that's the best that I can do on air for you guys. And at altitude, the barometric pressure drops, so P big A O2 falls even on at room air. And comparing the calculated P big A or alveolar O2 to the measured arterial P little a O2 gives the AA gradient, which is the central tool for sorting out hypoxemia. A couple of key concepts. Key concept 8, a normal AA gradient points to hypoventilation or low inspired O2. A widened gradient points to VQ mismatch, shunt, or diffusion limitation. And shunt's signature is hypoxemia that does not correct with 100% O2. Key concept 9, carbon dioxide is 20 times more diffusible than O2. So diffusion impairment causes hypoxemia long before hypercarbia. Apneic oxygenation works because the alveoli keep absorbing O2 after pre-oxygenation. And a commonly tested thing is the mirror image, which is diffusion hypoxia, when you're using nitrous oxide. And that's why we use 100% O2 when stopping nitrous oxide, because all of that is still in the blood and it'll be very rapidly absorbed and dilute out the oxygen in the lungs. I know you muted yourself, but bless you, Jed.
Thank you.
Are you ready for some questions?
I'm ready.
Question 10. What is the calculated PaO2 of a patient on room air in Denver, Colorado? Assume a barometric pressure of 630 millimeters per mercury, a respiratory quotient of 0.8, and a PaCO2 of 34 millimeters of mercury. Is it A, 80, B, 90, or C, 100?
Yeah, and so here we have to go back to the equation that you gave us of the alveolar gas equation. And so we are going to take the 630, which is the atmospheric pressure, minus the partial pressure of H2O, which you also need to know for this, which they don't give you. I think they would probably give you that on a test, at least I would hope. But that's 47. So 630 minus 47 times 0.21. The room air PaO2, and then minus the PaCO2 of 34 divided by the respiratory quotient of 0.8. And if you work all that out, it gets you 80. So that is your answer here. And you would have to know that equation in order to be able to calculate this.
And you will need to know that equation for your IT and for your basic. You will at some point be asked to calculate this.
Yeah.
Question 11, which of the following is most correct regarding apneic oxygenation? A low functional residual capacity to body weight ratio increases the time to tolerate apnea. B, a nasal cannula can effectively deliver oxygen during apneic oxygenation. Or C, the arterial partial pressure of carbon dioxide decreases during apneic oxygenation.
Yeah, so let's look at each answer. A low FRC increases the time to tolerate apnea. Nope, it's the opposite. It's going to decrease it. So we can get rid of A. B, a nasal cannula can effectively deliver oxygen during apneic oxygenation. It can. So if you know that, you know it. And then C, the arterial partial pressure of carbon dioxide decreases during apneic oxygenation. And so hopefully that just clearly can't be right. As you are not breathing, your partial pressure of carbon dioxide is going to go up because you're not breathing it out. So hopefully you can get rid of A and B, A and C, even if you don't know that the answer is B, but the correct answer is B.
Yeah, and I think sort of your explanation of C here is matches up with what you said earlier. Just remember that distinction between oxygenation and ventilation. You're oxygenating because the alveoli are filled enough with oxygen that it will continue to diffuse over time. from the alveoli that still have some oxygen to diffuse. But that carbon dioxide is going to very quickly equilibrate and then not go anywhere because you're not ventilating those.
Yeah, and you're still producing it. So it'll go up because you're not getting rid of it, but you're still producing it.
And question 12, at what percentage of shunt fraction, QS, QT, will 100% FiO2 have the least effect on PaO2?
You're going to give me my answer choices?
If you'd like them, sure. A, 10%, B, 20%, or C, 30%.
Yeah, I jumped in too early before, so I've got to give you the time. So the key here is knowing that shunt, as you said up top, is going to cause 100% FiO2. The more shunt you have, the less effect increasing to 100% FiO2 will have. And so here it's just a matter of which is the most shunt. And so C, 30%. The more shunt you have, the less effect increasing your FiO2 to 100% will have.
Yeah, this is one of those questions that I love because you look at it, you see QS, QT, you see 100% in the stem, you see three answers that you think you're going to have to somehow reason out mathematically, and there's absolutely no math in this question. It's just, do you know that shunt does not respond to increased oxygen? And if so, if you know that, then the more shunt, the less it'll respond.
Absolutely.
All right, section 5, oxygen carrying capacity and the oxyhemoglobin curve. Oxygen content is overwhelmingly hemoglobin bound. Another equation that we need to know is that the O2 content is equal to 1.39 times the hemoglobin times the SaO2 plus 0.003 times the PaO2. So that dissolved term, that second part, is usually trivial. The oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve relates saturation to PaO2 in a sigmoid shape, and P50, the PaO2 at 50% saturation, is a number that marks where the middle of that curve sits. Key concept 10, oxygen content tracks hemoglobin concentration and saturation, not PaO2. Pushing PaO up O2 when the blood is already fully saturated barely changes the content. Again, that last term, the dissolved term, is negligible. Key concept 11, your P50 is around 26 to 27 millimeters per mercury. A right shift, which is lower affinity, easier tissue unloading, comes from acidosis, hypercarbia, hyperthermia, increased 2-3 DPG, and volatiles. And remember, those are all situations in which you would want more tissue unloading. So when the tissue is working a lot, creating a lot of carbon dioxide, which is making that local tissue acidotic, all of those things will favor unloading. So it's a self-balancing thing. And the left shift comes from the opposites of what we just described, plus fetal hemoglobin, carboxyhemoglobin, and methemoglobin. Got it out there. A low PaO2 just moves you along the existing curve. It is not a shift of the curve itself. Anything to add before we do some questions?
No, I think that last one is really important because it can be tricky, but that's kind of what the curve is measuring. So you're not changing it. You're just, as you said, you're moving up back and forth on the x-axis by having a lower or higher PaO2. Perfect. But you're not shifting the curve itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that though there are some factors in the blood, such as the hemoglobins themselves and the 2-3 DPG that do shift some things, I sometimes think of this as sort of the tissue sets where the curve is, depending on how much or how little unloading it needs. And then the blood content, your PaO2, is sort of where you live on that curve.
Yeah.
Okay. Question 13. Hemoglobin has been stable at 15 grams per deciliter. Blood gas analysis immediately before induction reveals a PaO2 of 120 millimeters of mercury and an arterial saturation of 100%. After induction, the PaO2 rises to 150 millimeters per mercury and the saturation remains the same. How has the oxygen content of his patient's blood changed? A, it has increased by 10%. B, it has increased by 5%. Or C, it has increased by less than 1%.
Yeah, so tricky. Just thinking about it, you may say, oh, it went from 120 to 150. That's a pretty significant increase. That's an increase of 30. That's 25%, which actually, interestingly, is not one of the options. So maybe you can realize that can't be right. But And I do think it'd be very likely they might put 25% as an option there on the real test, because that would be an obvious distractor. But the key is remembering that in the oxygen content equation that you went over, you multiply the PaO2 by 0.003. So that change of 30, you have to multiply by 0.003. It's going to be a tiny increase percentage-wise. And so the answer is C, less than 1%.
Yeah, you don't need to do the math. It's negligible.
Yep.
Question 14, the P50 for normal adult hemoglobin is approximately A, 15 millimeters of mercury, B, 25 millimeters of mercury, or C, 35 millimeters of mercury.
This you just have to know, and the answer is 25.
But it'll come up either as a standalone question, less likely, or you will need to know it for answering some question related to oxygen carrying capacity or the oxyhemoglobin curve. So we put it there. And question 15, which of the following will shift the oxyhemoglobin dissociation, each of the following will shift the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve to the right, except A, volatile anesthetics, B, decreased PaO2, or C, decreased pH.
So as you went over, decreased pH and volatiles will in fact shift it right. But remember we said decreased PaO2 just moves you along the curve. It doesn't shift it. So the answer is B.
That's right. Decreased PaO2 is not a leftward shift. It's just no shift.
Right.
Section 6, carbon dioxide transport and carbon monoxide. CO2 is carried three ways. As bicarbonate, that's the majority. It's generated by carbonic anhydrase in the red cell. Bound to hemoglobin as carbaminohemoglobin and dissolved. Two effects link the O2 and CO2 transport cycles. There's the Bohr effect, where acidosis and carbon dioxide right shift the O2 curve to favor tissue unloading. And this is what we've been talking about when we talk about a right shift on the oxyhemoglobin curve. And the Haldane effect, where deoxygenated hemoglobin carries more CO2, favoring pickup in the tissues and release in the lung. If you know one of these, you'll know that the other is the other effect. So I would just memorize one by name. And remember that both just help unload oxygen where it's needed and carry away carbon dioxide from where it's generated highly. So if you think of highly metabolic tissue, the Bohr effect will make it more likely that O2 is dumped off. And the fact that less O2 is on that hemoglobin will make it more likely that that hemoglobin can carry more CO2 away from that area that's generating it.
Yep.
Key concept 12. When carbon dioxide binds hemoglobin, it binds it with 200 times the affinity of O2 and
carbon monoxide, I think, right?
Carbon monoxide binds it with 200 times the affinity of O2 and it left shifts the curve. So O2 content is dangerously low while the PaO2 looks normal. A standard pulse oximeter also falsely reads a reassuring value because it can't distinguish between carboxyhemoglobin from oxyhemoglobin. You'll see this tested such as in question 16. A 33-year-old woman with 20% carboxyhemoglobin is brought to the ER for treatment of smoke inhalation. Which of the following is least consistent with a diagnosis of carbon monoxide poisoning? A, 98% oxygen saturation on dual wavelength pulse oximeter. B, PaO2 of 105 millimeters per mercury, oxygen saturation 80% on initial room air arterial blood gases, or C, cyanosis.
Yeah, so as you said, you're going to have a false elevation of your SAT, so that is likely, A is likely, that it may read 98%, even though that's reading the carboxyhemoglobin. B, PaO2 of 105, but a SAT of 80 on initial room air arterial blood gas. That's key. That's not the SAT on the pulse oximeter. That's on the blood gas itself. So that is also likely because you have enough oxygen in the blood that you should have 100% SAT, but you don't. So that's because of the carbon monoxide. Cyanosis is something you wouldn't see because you get not cyanosis, but in fact, that cherry red appearance. So you would look quite pink or red, but not cyanotic, even though you are, in fact, you do not have enough oxygen in your blood or being delivered to your tissues.
Yeah. Okay. Section 7, we won't have any questions here, but this is going to be the non-respiratory lung functions and perioperative smoking. this is less tested, but because we want to round out this section of the Confluent outline, there's a couple of quick hits I want you to know just in case it does come up. The lung's non-respiratory functions are that it filters microthrombi, converts angiotensin 1 to 2, and clears some catecholamines and serves as an immune barrier. There's not great ways to test this, so they don't. And in terms of perioperative smoking, I think the things that you might want to know for the test are that carboxyhemoglobin clears within 12 to 24 hours, so short cessation improves oxygen delivery quickly, but meaningful reductions in pulmonary complications need several weeks of abstinence. And we've all seen that, you know, the person that quit smoking a couple days before, they may have better oxygen delivery, but they will be coughing, hacking, more prone to bronchospasm, especially early in that period that they quit.
Yeah. And so part of that, too, is that they have still they're producing excess secretions because of the smoking, but their ciliary function is starting to come back a little. And so it's coming up. So now they've got all this instead of just sitting down in their lung, they've got all these secretions that are now starting to come up into their upper airways. And so they're going to be coughing and hacking more. So you could actually have increased secretions and airway reactivity because of all that in the days after stopping.
Perfect. So like I said, no actual questions or actual keywords for that little section. So that is all we've got today.
Fabulous. Well, this was great. Let's go to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Tim, what would you recommend people check out for fun?
I am going to recommend Funny AF with Kevin Hart, which is a Netflix, I don't know what to call it, like a game show or reality TV thing. He brings on comics from multiple cities and tries to find the best comic. Show is, totally watchable. There's nothing about sort of, style of the tournament that is especially appealing, but the comedians are absolutely hilarious. I don't often watch TV. I very rarely binge shows. And, my wife and I got through this probably in a few days because we couldn't put it down.
Nice. Fabulous. I'm going to recommend a TV show called The Landman. And I had actually heard about this and I thought about watching it, but then I looked it up and the Rotten Tomato reviews were okay, but not great. So I had decided not worth my time. And then some of the parents on my daughter's lacrosse team were saying they were really enjoying it. So I said, okay, I'll check it out. And it is worth it. It is very funny. I mean, I'm maybe halfway through the first season, but, I'll just say that, Billy Bob Thornton plays a dad who has a 17-year-old daughter. And as a father of teenage daughters, I will tell you that they really do a nice job of poking fun at that relationship and at some of the eccentricities of the teenage daughter. So if you especially are a father of teenage daughters, I would highly recommend watching it. You will laugh pretty hard. And for anyone else, you'll probably be entertained as well. All right, Tim, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me again.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew.
Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Chidima Ikanti, Rachel Furman, and Mohammed Celeb are our production assistants and social media managers.
Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.